Okay, welcome back. This is our fifth session in our Modern Jewish series. Mostly our series has really been focused on modern Jewish history as it relates to laying the groundwork for the rebirth of the State of Israel. Now, no process that is as significant as this, as the rebirth and return to our homeland, can be done in a simple, clean manner. That's just not the way that these kinds of things go. There are many forces at play, both within the Jewish world and as the Jewish world relates to the outside world around us. And this discussion that we'll have tonight of the what's known as the first Aliyah will bring many of those forces into play, both within the Jewish world and as it relates to the world around us, particularly the Arab world around us, which is, of course, the world into which this first Aliyah movement ends up. And those forces are both, as we've seen many times, the religious element, the messianic element, the secular element, all within the Jewish world, who are all doing similar things, but coming at it from very different perspectives. And then, of course, we'll have the Jew and the Arab conflict, the seeds of which will really begin to be watered as we learn about this particular episode in Jewish history and will unfortunately continue to sprout and grow over the next 100 years. So let's begin with what is known as the first Aliyah. You have the sheet in front of you. Let's start with the definition. The definition, when we refer to the first Aliyah, is the what is known as the influx of Jewish immigrants into the Ottoman-controlled Palestine between the years of 1882 and 1903. Some might have a year or two earlier, maybe beginning in 1880 and ending in 1900. It's clearly a 20-21 year period towards the end of the 19th century, the late 1800s, during which about 25,000 Jews immigrate to the land of Israel. Some estimates will put it at about 15,000. I've seen some go as high as 35,000. A significant amount of Jews arrive in the land of Palestine during this time. This is the late 1800s, and again, we're going to mention this many times. This is before Zionism. Herzl does not even begin his conferences until the late 1890s, following the Dreyfus Affair of the late 1896. So this is already happening 15-20 years prior that this movement of Jews to the land of Palestine is beginning. Mostly it comes from Russia, comes from Romania. There is a small percentage that comes from the land of Yemen as well. Some of the Yemenite Jews. I hope the sharing is going okay. We're going to, maybe there's a better way to share and make it bigger. We'll give it a shot. On the back end, they're going to be working on that. Now, a point on this definition is that historians will note, officially, you'll generally see five different waves of Aliyah. They'll delineate these five different periods. But that entire construct is a literally made-up construct to help us understand and identify and put into context. Meaning there was no date that we said, oh, this is the beginning of the first Aliyah, and now it ends. There are just historical waves which help us understand what's happened over the last 100 years. So for example, the second wave is defined from 1904 to 1914, the beginning of the First World War. But this idea that you would identify them as the first wave beginning in 1890, for example, those who had arrived during the previous 3, 4, 5 decades, or even in the late 1700s when the Jews began to return, we discussed the Talmidim, the students of the Vilna Gaon, the students of the Baal Shem Tov began to come. They've been there for 100 years already. They might, for example, take issue with this idea that that is called the first Aliyah in 1890. Additionally, accurate numbers are very hard to come by during this period of time. The Ottoman authorities certainly were not interested in keeping accurate records. The local Arabs were not happy that they arrived. And a large percentage of the Jews who come don't make it. They return somewhere else. As we're going to see, it was quite a difficult and harsh existence during those days. But at the end of the day, given that the population estimates in total was around 150,000, so to say that a 10 to 15% increase of 25,000 Jews are going to show up, even the smaller amounts of 15,000, it's going to make an impact. It's noticeable. You can't sneak that amount of people into a size of a population that's really relatively small without it having some type of impact. So let's break this down a little bit into a couple of different components. Number one, what did they find when they got there? What was already there when this wave of Jews arrived? So we've discussed this in the past. We'll go over some of this just to refresh our memories. As I mentioned just a moment ago, in the early 1800s already, students from the Vilna Gaon, the Baal Shem Tov, the Vilna Gaon represented what we call the Misnagdim, the non-Hasidic Jews. The Baal Shem Tov and a number of other Hasidic masters either came or sent their Hasidim. They already began coming throughout the late 1700s, early 1800s, and that was strictly for religious purposes, and they are referred to as the Yishuv Hayashan, the old settlers with the old settlements. They were observant, they were traditional, and that's what they found from the small, indigenous Sephardic brethren who were already there. We've mentioned the general, the Jews who were there throughout all of the Middle Ages were a small pocket of Sephardic Jews. And so all of the Jewish community was what we would call observant. This is before the advent, or before it certainly came to that area of the world of Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, the secular movement, the Enlightenment. None of that had touched the Jews in Palestine at that time. So throughout the 1800s, it is a traditional religious community beginning to be blended between the Ashkenaz, Hasidim, and the Sephardim, each of them having their communities, and as we mentioned, because it was so small, they managed to get along far better than the Hasidim and the Misnagdim were able to get along in Europe, where it was a lot of antagonism. In the land of Israel, they managed to do fine. And this is what our Jews find. That's the community that they arrive in as they get to the land of Palestine. Most of these Jews lived in cities, in Tzfat, and Tveria, Yerushalayim, and Hebron are the major cities in which the Jews settle, and they are generally a pious and holy people who have sacrificed a great deal to be there. They lived simple, austere, and pious lives. That's what that's how they existed. Part of that was because they had no choice. The physical conditions were terrible. Poverty, disease. The Turks were discriminatory and corrupt. There was almost no economy to speak of. There was no way for them to support themselves independently. The land itself, rocky and barren. It was underdeveloped. It was sparsely settled. It was hot. You know, we go now and it's uncomfortable, and we have all of the amenities and the luxuries, the creature comforts that exist now. It was hot. It was dusty. It was a hard place to live. We've mentioned before the way that they existed was based on what was called the chalukah. The chalukah was the system in which Jews throughout Europe would basically support them. They would, the local, every little shtetl had a little pushka in their home, and they would give it to the Rav, and the Rav would give it to the Rav of the next city, and he would give it to the Rav of the big city, and the Rav of the big city would collect all the money, and they would send it off to the land of Israel. And we mentioned that was an impossibly inequitable system. It's the best that they had. But, you know, as the money's coming in, and if it came from the different communities wanted to go to different places, then who got, who didn't get, it was complicated. But that was the only way that they could possibly subsist. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who became the Rav of Yerushalayim later in his life, who was there, likened the Jews of Yerushalayim to an army that was stationed far away from home to defend national interests. And therefore, it was the responsibility of the home country to support its army as it went out, so to speak, into the fields to defend national interests. You needed to support them. And they viewed the Jews who were there, this small band in an inhospitable, economically depressed area, were the responsibility of Jews around the world to support. And mostly the Jews around the world felt it was a worthy cause. It was, again, relatively small, and they would send money. That's how things that went. Another complication that the Jews in the land of Palestine at the time had is that they were all dimmi. I'm probably mispronouncing that, which was the Arabic word for an infidel, meaning anyone who wasn't a Muslim. As the Quran defined that a Muslim was not allowed to live in the same country as another religion, that was understood to mean of equal status. You were allowed to have non-Muslims in your country, but you couldn't grant them, and this is meaning like by law, you couldn't have the same rights as the local Muslim population. This is expressed in a really fantastic way by a writing by W.T. Young, who was the British consul in Yerushalayim in 1839. And he writes in his diary, "Scarcely a day passes that I do not hear of some act of tyranny and oppression against a Jew." That's common. The local Turks and Arabs would constantly oppress the Jew. And he writes, "In two instances, I have succeeded in obtaining justice for Jews against the Turks." And he concludes, "But it is quite a new thing in the eyes of these people to claim justice for a Jew." Like, they couldn't imagine that, like, what do you mean you're looking for justice for a Jew? That's not how things work. We don't do that this way here. And that was the system as it was. It was, you're here, this is our land, but don't think you're going to have equal status before the law. And the Jew understood that and lived that way. We're going to see that the Muslims never really were, you know, they weren't always great friends of the Jew, but the type of anti-Semitism, it wasn't anti-Semitism as much as it was, you're not a Muslim. So because you're not a Muslim, you're going to be persecuted about. By the 20th century, the Eastern European anti-Semitism will make its way to the Arab world as well, and which only gets worse and worse for us as we are there. But in any case, this is a system that the Jews who are arriving, this is what they find. They find a difficult place to live, and they find a Jewish population that is certainly accustomed to being persecuted and not on equal status with their Arab neighbors. By the mid-1800s, I mentioned in one of our previous lectures that there are, you could look at 100 different censuses and you'll see different numbers, but at some point, the Jews become the majority of Jerusalem as they're trickling in. Again, this is 50 years before Herzl, it's before the first Aliyah, we're literally in the mid-1800s, about 17 of the 25,000 Jews are living in Yerushalayim, and they become the majority of the city, and infrastructure begins to take shape. Again, we've spoken about this at greater length. Montefiore begins to purchase land west of the old city. The first hospital opens. Bikur Cholim opens. The Churva Synagogue opens in Yerushalayim. So that by 1868, listen to these numbers, there were 21 shuls functioning in Yerushalayim, only 11 mosques, and a similar 21 churches. There was a strong presence of Christian Arabs in Yerushalayim, who were remnants, historically speaking, from the Crusader period, and they maintained a Christian Arab population for hundreds of years, and those were the numbers. So the Jews were a strong presence, but amongst themselves, as we unfortunately are familiar with, the Jews had a lot of trouble getting together and functioning in a unified way amongst the different groups as they grew. And, you know, when we're very small, we're very good at that. It's you know, this has been this way throughout Jewish history. You find a small town where there are barely, you know, 25, 30 Jews, there'll be one shul in town. As soon as you get, the numbers begin to swell, then all of a sudden, this one is not good enough, and I don't want to be with this one, I'm on my own. That's how we function. For better, for worse, that's the way that it's been, it's the way that it was. So as the Jewish population of Yerushalayim gets bigger and bigger, the problems amongst the different groups get bigger and bigger as well. There's a fantastic quote here you have on your notes from the British archaeologist Charles Warren. He is, of course, famous for a lot of his archaeological digs along the Kotel. He writes in his memoirs on Yerushalayim in 1876, this is a fantastic quote, There is an irrepressible pride and presumption about this fragile and wayward people of Ashkenaz that I cannot help but admire. They're dressed in greasy rags. They stalk about the old city with as much dignity as though they were dressed in the richest garments and give way to no one. Years of oppression have in no way quelled their ancient spirit. And if they could only be induced to work and become united, they would be a very formidable race, for their courage and fortitude makes up for the want of physical stamina. So he discusses, like, who are these people? They're walking around, they're poverty-stricken, they're like nobodies, but they walk around like they own the world. And there's a certain dignity that they carry themselves with. And if they could only get together, wow, what a people these people would be. But that's Charles Warren describing the Jewish people in the late 1870s. Okay, so our new immigrants began to arrive. Now, why did they come? Well, one last point. The people who were there, we're going to get back to this, were fiercely protective of Jerusalem. The Jews who were there made a decision from the late 1700s throughout the 1800s of, we're going back home. Nobody went because they thought they were going to have a better life. It just wasn't set up for that, but it was driven by a sense of the time to end the exile has come. This is going to begin the ushering in of a messianic era, and we are going to be there to be the guardians, waiting for everyone's arrival, helping the seeds of the returning of the Jews flourish. It was a fierce, it was a strong, and it was a religious group that was primarily there. And now we get the newcomers. Where did they come from? So they came again from two primary places. One was Eastern Europe, from Russia and other areas. Why did they come? A number of different reasons. Number one, there was mass, that should be an E, immigration out of Russia towards the end of the 19th century. In general, hundreds of thousands of Jews left by 1920 from 1880 to 1920 out of Russia, both because of population increases in Russia, economic problems. Most went to the US and elsewhere. And a number of them came, again, 25,000 out of the hundreds of thousands that left and out of the millions of Jews that were in Russia. It's a very small percentage, but a number of them came to get out of Russia. Why were they so intent on getting out of Russia? Because of terrible Jewish persecution, besides for the general exodus out of Russia from all people, but the Jewish persecution was horrible. We've had, again, if you remember, we had earlier in the 1800s, the terrible canonist decrees against the Jewish children going into the army by that which ended in the 1850s. 30 years later, it's back. Tsar Alexander II was assassinated, and of course, who was to blame for his assassination? That would be the Jews. And so a series of what was became known as the May Laws were instituted. Of course, they were only temporary, so they only lasted 30 years. Once, this is everybody's fear, like once you institute something, then it's so much easier just to keep it going. So they instituted, they stayed, and it lasted 30 years in which, in policy, the Jew was prohibited from mobility, social mobility, physical mobility. They were locked into the Pale of Settlement. They were forbidden to settle in towns. They were forbidden to buy land outside of their little towns. They couldn't lease areas outside of their little towns that they were forced into. They were prohibited from doing business on Sunday. There were quotas on high schools. There were areas in Jewish areas where the high schools were half empty because the schools weren't allowed to take a certain number of students, and the rest of the kids literally, you know, couldn't do anything. You weren't allowed to go to school. There were quotas on physicians, both in general and even in the army. How many you were allowed to take that were Jewish? They were prohibited then from selling alcohol. It was illegal to then. So, of course, what did the Jews start? They took Christian names. They made it illegal for a Jew to be caught using a Christian name. It was a terrible series of decrees. And then they had anti-Jewish pogroms, which were state-run, state-instituted, where there would just be terrible pogroms throughout the Pale of Settlement. And so there were mass exodus, which the Russians were not unhappy about. They were happy to get rid of the Jews. There were two major waves in the early 1880s and again in the early 1890s. So there was a general movement out of Russia. Now that is, and those groups that left for that reason, that was what's driving them? Persecution. We have to get out. Where should we go? So most went to the U.S. or other places, and some came to Israel. And like it is today, when a person today declares they're making Aliyah, they're moving to Israel. So why are you leaving? So some people are driven by idealistic, it's the right place to, I have to be home. I can't be in the exile anymore. It's going to be hard. I'm going to struggle, but that's where I'm going. Others leave because there are problems wherever they're coming from, whether they're leaving France, whether they're leaving Italy or Russia or any other place where there's a problem. What's driving the move to Israel is I can't stay here. And once I need to leave, let's try Israel. So you had a group of Jews leaving Russia who were leaving because of persecution. They could not stay where they were. Then you have another group coming out of Russia, which are the Chovavei Tzion. And we discussed this again in past weeks as an entire class. The Chovavei Tzion, the lovers of Zion, Chibat Tzion, as they were referred to, was a group that was founded, again, before Herzl, to help and assist Jews get out of Russia and move to Palestine. This group, as we discussed at length, was a complicated group because it was originally founded by religious Jews for religious purposes, but it ended up being really run by secular non-religious Jews, and it had a mixed bag of attendees and religious influences on it. But the majority, again, were secular, they were agnostic, they were not interested in being a light to the nation, they were interested in being alike the nations. They wanted to be the same. And so this one movement had these various different components, and it became very strong among the young idealistic secular Jews who were interested in an agricultural settlement. We mentioned this again when we spoke about the Chovev Etzion. It was to set up agriculture, to teach Jews to farm, to settle the land, and to develop it. And the secular Jews brought with it the idea of creating a new cultural Jew in the process, that the move to Israel was going to leave aside the Altaheim. That's old. We're done with that. We're going to create a new Jew here in the land in Israel. And so this group came. Many of the older traditional Jews came and they settled in the cities, and a lot of the younger, more idealistic, secular Jews settled in new settlements and farms. And this paradox of what was the Chovev Etzion would always haunt that movement. It couldn't define itself, and it was always being torn and pushed in different ways, and it would eventually undo the movement, and then it would follow the successor to the Chovev Etzion, which is Herzl's movement of political Zionism, would then struggle with the same tensions amongst the Jewish people. Can you imagine that? A group of Jews can't figure out what they want to be. So they would always say, what is it? Is it a religious Zionism? Is it a secular Zionism? Is it a green? All the different elements would always, and this would continue really almost until today. The group that organized to come to the land of Israel had a name for themselves. They called the organization Bilu or Biluim. The term Bilu was from a phrase from Tanakh, from the Navi, B'nei Yisrael luchu v'neilecha. The Beis, if you take the first letter of that phrase, B'nei Yisrael bet yud lamed vav, is Bilu. B'nei Yisrael luchu v'neilecha. Jewish people, get up and let's go. It's the plea of the Navi, of the prophet, saying it's time to leave the exodus, time to leave the exile and go home. Which is always an amazing thing that the name of the group took from Tanakh. It's time to get up and leave the exile behind. There's no future for us here. It's time to go home. Now, it's interesting. They left out the next two words of the pasuk, which is Laor Hashem, by the light of Hashem. And so they just took the phrase, come, get up and go. Get up and go in following Hashem's ways to come to the land of Israel. But they were called Biluim. And again, it was not necessarily all a religious group, but that was its name that they had taken as they begin to arrive in Palestine. So that's the Eastern European group. Plus, we have from Yemen as well. The group, the Yemenite Jews who come, were after the 1869 opening of the Suez Canal. I think that's misspelled there in front of you. It changed the nature of travel throughout the Ottoman Empire, made it much easier to get up through to Ottoman Syria, and a messianic fervor swept through the Yemenite community, and from about a 35-year period, from 1880 to 1914, about 10% of the population moves to Israel. So now, again, it's not a huge number, but it was significant based on the percentage of the Jews that were there. And they were, in general, a religious group who comes. But unfortunately, as is part of the history that we can whitewash, they did not necessarily find the warmest of welcomes or accommodating absorption from the different groups, which is becoming more Ashkenized as time is going on. So again, you have a local Sephardic population. You now have a new Yemenite population coming in. You have a new Ashkenaz population coming, which is divided, some religious, some, the majority, secular. Now, what's the result and the reaction of their arrival as these 25,000 Jews arrive in the relatively small populated area of Palestine over this 15-20 year period? So as you can imagine, it was not necessarily simple. And that really manifested itself on two primary levels, which is really the bulk of of what we need to highlight this evening. Number one is a let's call it a Jew versus a Jew issue. It just as you, one can imagine complications. Let's talk it through. Number one was on a philosophical level. Now this is an issue which we've addressed before, but it's important to acknowledge again here. Whether or not the Jews should be returning to the Holy Land was a hotly debated point within the religious world. World Jewry debated this point. Already in the 1850s, we have published books, Sfarim, that were written on both sides of the aisle by well-read and respected halachic authorities, whether or not it's time to go home, imploring Jews to get up and go. And on the other side, many Sfarim saying it is absolutely forbidden. And we've gone through in the past some of the classic passages in the Talmud, which would point to one way or another, and whether or not it was the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. While it's a trickle of Jews that are there, then we could view them as our outpost of our army, and we have an obligation to support them, because after all, they're protecting our national interests, and there should always be a Jewish presence in the land of Israel. But when that shifts from a Jewish presence to a movement where it's now significant, that brought out this very, again, this has nothing to do with Zionism, it has nothing to do with Herzl. It's within the Jewish world, is this what's supposed to happen or not? And again, I just want, we've talked about this before, I just want to stress, we're 100+ years after that. We're looking back historically, and we now see the land of Israel for what it has become, what it is, what it represents to the Jewish people in its modern form. And I imagine all of you listening to this are fully in favor and supportive of that. This is before that. This is the Jew in exile. There is no state of Israel. It's the Ottoman Empire. And there's now a mass wave of, over a 20-year period, 25,000 Jews going back, which is exactly what the Talmud said, seemingly, should not happen, not to go up like on a wave. So this created a massive debate whether this is good or bad for the Jews, who need, not only were they barely holding on to with the support of the Chalukah when it was a small group, you now just increase significantly the number of Jews who need more help, more support, and a debate whether or not this was actually the good thing or the right thing to be done. That's just on a philosophical level, and this, is only going to get worse with the creation of Zionism in the early 1900s. Secondly, besides for the philosophical level, we now have it on a practical level. Because put yourself in the shoes of the Jew who's there from 1830, and your family's been there for 50, 60 years, and you're somehow managing along. And then, not just one family, not just two families, hundreds, thousands of Jews start coming, and you're not coming with jobs. It's just not the way that it worked. How's everyone going to get, where's the food? Where are we going to support? How is this going to work? So We now have an old yeshuv barely surviving, inundated with immigrants. Amongst this group of immigrants, you have, of course, traditionalists. You have religious Jews, some of whom are coming because they believe Mashiach is on its way. So you have some guy show up next door who thinks the Messiah is on his way. So you got to deal with that guy. Then you have a guy coming who's simply running from the persecution of Russia. All he wants is a place to live, and he's willing to trade in whatever persecutions of Russia for his Arab neighbor, and he's here. They're mostly Ashkenaz, these newcomers, and then the majority of them are not in those two camps of religious Jews, some who are coming with messianic fervor, and some are just trying to get away. Then you have a strong, secular, non-observant group of Jews who are actively interested in creating a new Jew in the mold of the nations of the world. When you've worked against everything going against you for 60, 70, 80, 100 years to maintain your hold on Yerushalayim as the holy city, and now it's inundated with those who don't see it as that holy city. So there was a lot of new and old yeshuv tensions. This comes just as an example, came to a head in the Shemitah crisis of 1889. Shemitah, of course, is the law in the Torah that says every 7 years the land in Israel must remain fallow. You're not permitted to work the land. And that had been observed for all these years in a small number of Jews that lived there. So the previous Shemitah of 1882, 7 years prior, there had been a small number of farmers, and they observed the year, the Shemitah year. But now, between 1882 and 1889, there had been an influx of thousands of Jews, new towns, a moshav here, a moshav there. They're all subsisting by trying to farm the land. And the understanding was these new settlers who were backed by the Baron Rothschild, who was supporting all of these developing towns, who said, if we take a year off, the whole project is going to collapse. The endeavor is not going to survive. We cannot observe Shemitah 1889. It won't work. Now, think about the impossible quagmire and all the various factors that come into play here. A large number of the farmers are secularists. They could care less about Shemitah. It's not on their radar. They're not interested. They're going to work the field like they've always were planning on doing, so they're not interested. Them working the field draws the ire of these traditionalist Jews who've been here for the last 60, 70 years, who have done everything to maintain Torah law, Torah Judaism, and observance, and now this new young schnook shows up from Russia who's going to violate my land and work it on Shemitah when it hasn't been worked before for all of these years. You can't. So they're angry at the youngs, like, you can't. You're not allowed to do this. The seconds, they don't care at all. On top of that, you have religious farmers who would like to be able to observe the laws and simply say, I'm not going to survive. I can't. It's not going to work. How am I supposed to do this? So all of these different ideas. So what happened? So this is still during the era of the Chovevei Tzion. They were still the main body that was sending and helping to support. They had a panel of three great rabbis who were their board, so to speak, of religious matters. They convened to figure out what should we do about this problem of Shemitah 1889. Two of the three came to the conclusion that they're going to allow what's called the Aheter Mechira, meaning permission to sell the land to a non-Jew, similar to what we do with our chametz on Pesach. I'm not allowed to own chametz, no problem. I'll sell it to a non-Jew. I don't own the chametz. I'll buy it back after Pesach. A similar construct would be created for Shemitah. A Jew's not allowed to work the land. You're not allowed to work your land if it's owned by a Jew. Let's sell it to the Arab neighbor, and then it's really his. We'll continue to work it and work out a deal with the Arab in terms of he'll get some crops and we'll get some. We'll be able to continue working and developing. We'll be able to survive, and we'll get around the problem. One of the three did not accept this. It is a super complicated idea whether or not that works. Selling chametz is one thing. Selling the land of Israel, who says that you're not allowed to work only your land? Maybe you're not allowed to work any land of the land of Israel during a Shemitah. It was a hotly contested issue whether or not you're allowed to sell land to a non-Jew. Are you allowed to sell our own whole land? Maybe you're not allowed to sell the land. Even if you are allowed to sell the land, maybe it doesn't help and you're still not allowed to work it. It was a major to-do. One of the three held out against it, the Netziv, Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, the great yeshiva, Volozhin Yeshiva, said he was against it. Two of the three were in favor of it. The two of the three who were in favor of it found others who would support it, and they published the Heter. They published the permission to sell to a non-Jew, and it was backed by the Gadol Hador, the greatest halachic authority of the generation, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. He wrote a long treatise explaining that this was an acceptable thing to do, to sell the land. So he had the backing of the big three, not the original big three, but the backing of three from the Chovevei Tzion, and then the greatest posek of the generation followed it as well. The Jews, the Rabbanim of Yerushalayim, rejected it. They said, don't send us responsa from Europe telling us what we're allowed to do in the holy city of Yerushalayim. We're here, we don't accept this. And so this created the great Shemitah controversy, which continues until this very day. It was never finalized, not in halacha, not in practice. And what happened was the original permission was given specifically only for 1889. It was renewed in 1896 with less opposition, and it was renewed again following the year 1903, and then it just became part of the system, where now the question is, do you accept it, do you not accept it, but it's here. And that is literally, and still until today, if you go to Israel during a Shemitah year, you will see some farms that have big, huge signs and banners in their fields that say, Kan Shomrim Shemitah. Here we observe the laws of Shemitah, we're not working at all, and there are other farms that are working and are not even doing anything, they're just working it as the Jews, and then you have those who are selling it to the non-Jews, and so if you go to a supermarket during the Shemitah year, you'll have all your options. It's complicated what you want to buy, where did it come from, how has it worked. That began during this period of the first Aliyah in 1889 with this controversial permission that was granted to the farmers at the time, and that simply is just an example of the various camps and the everyone had it. You know, the Jews of the rabbis of Yerushalayim felt strongly like, why should we change? What was this about? Let me just add this one last point. How much should we adapt to the modern world and modern needs of what's going on? The traditional approach was clear. The Torah says you can't work. That's what we've done for many hundreds of years. But now we have a new world. We have new needs. We have this, that. So how much should we adapt? So the traditionalist said, we don't adapt at all. Leave us alone. This is the way that it's been. This is what it says. This is how we're going to do it. Then you had a group of moderates in the middle who said, okay, let's find a way. We'll sell. We'll do this. We'll make it work within halacha. We'll change only what we need. And there are those who accepted, those who didn't accept, and those who weren't interested in doing anything. And welcome to the Jewish world, both of, if it sounds like, that sounds familiar, yes, the same Jewish world of 1889 is the same Jewish world of 2021 as well in many ways. So that was an issue which was brought out. And this is, of course, going to continue with the birth of Zionism, which we spoke about already. But as that takes hold and begins to really become a movement of actually taking control of the land as a political movement to create a state, we're not there yet. All we're talking about now is the Jews are there trying to make a living for themselves, and they're coming back. When the Zionist movement takes hold, which again, as I said, like Jewish history works, it's like hard to do it linearly. You just have to take all the different pieces and put them together, that's only going to further this complication of what kind of state is this? A Jewish state, a religious state, a Jewish state that's religious run by Jews who are not religious, what is it? And we haven't figured that out until today, but that's where all of this starts from. That's one major issue that this first Aliyah brought to the forefront, were those different voices, which were no longer just dealing in Europe as they were now living together and trying to figure out how to make it go in the land of Israel. The other major issue, of course, is the Jew and the Arab complication. This complication, which of course begins right as they get there, reflected a certain naivety of the Jewish settlers of what to do with the Arabs that are there. Now, in a certain way, it wasn't really addressed at all. And not only did the Jews of the first Aliyah not really think about it, that was followed in practice by the early Zionists as well. They're Arabs who live here. They're more than us that are already clear. So what's the plan? So the plan became to just ignore it, to completely ignore the reality of the Arab presence and simply, I don't want to say like pretend like they're not there, but basically pretend like they're not there. Let's come, keep moving in, develop infrastructure, develop our cities, and whatever. You know, at some point, someone's going to have to deal with it. Now, in hindsight, this is really an insoluble problem. I don't know that anyone would have come up with a better plan in hindsight than what was done. But at the time, they just sort of came. And this is really where it begins, this first Aliyah period of history. Because remember, until now, it's a trickle of Jews. I don't say it's barely noticed, but there's nothing that forced the issue, even as they continue to go, even as they hit the majority in Yerushalayim, as we mentioned, but they were not the ruling class. They were still subject to being second rate in the Muslim-controlled area, and now again, 25,000 show up. And it had a number of ramifications. So firstly, most of the local Muslim Arabs at the time, there were some, of course, Bedouin Arabs and some Christian Arabs, but the majority were Muslim Arabs. And there were two tiers, two different social sects. The lower known as the Farahin, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing as well. They were the lowest of the rung. They were the serfs who basically worked fields for absentee landlords who lived in Lebanon, modern-day Lebanon, or Syria, or Turkey, or Egypt. And this lowest level on the totem pole, these Farahins, were literally always stuck in poverty. They had archaic tools to work the land. They were always illiterate and uneducated, and it was almost forced upon them by the landowners, mistreated in a classic example, like it was Arab mistreating Arab, that they were stuck in that and could never ever get out of that. There were so many different groups that were working even a single field that they would just barely be able to eke out a living. And they were the majority of the Arabs that lived there. Of course, then you have the second group, were known as the town Arabs. They were the middle-class merchant or shopkeepers who lived in the cities of Nablus or Jerusalem or Hebron or Jaffa. And they were a little bit more educated, and those were the two groups. Now, what happens is, as the Jews from the first Aliyah start settlements and farms, because that was the Chovav Etzion's thing, was work the land, start the moshavs, which they did successfully. Many, many different moshavs were started. We'll see in a moment a long list of them. That alone is enraging to the local Arab population, that all of a sudden, this land, which had sparsely populated, people come in and they start buying up and starting new settlements. Now, every person who's in a certain land is always going to view this as their land. That's a natural human instinct, that if you've been living on a land for any period of time, more than the guy who just came, whether you're there for 2 weeks more than him, 2 years, 20 years, or 200 years, if you're there more than the new guy, who are you to come here and start all of this? So, well, that's in essence what happened. Not only do they then start a moshav, a settlement, and start to farm, they begin hiring these Arab workers who were literally, you know, the modern day building your factory in China because it's cheaper. So in the late 1800s, so the equivalent of that was you could hire Arab labor who were getting paid literally peanuts next door, pay them a little bit more, and you could have a working class that are very happy to be working for you because they're getting it better than they were previously, and now you have your cheap labor. So the Jews who come begin hiring their Arab workers. Well, when that happens, a number of things happen after that. Number one, they start getting, the whole class system as it had been set up was thrown out of balance in the Arab world, because they're now getting treated better than their absentee owner. And more Arabs start moving because the opportunity in the land of Palestine suddenly becomes far better for a lower stratosphered Arab than in any of the neighboring Arab areas. So as the economy grows, more and more Arabs move. Each wave of Jewish immigration brings a double and triple wave of Arab immigration from neighboring countries. So that even though the numbers were relatively small, again, there was a higher percentage of Arabs than Jews in 1850, by 1948, there are over 2 million Arabs in Israel from 150,000 in the 1850s. It expands exponentially. They happen to have large, large families. And they follow the opportunity. It created a lot of problems. Besides for the fact that the Jews were now hiring the Arabs and giving them better opportunities, it creates, you know, the socialist sociologists will describe an inferiority complex mixed with European anti-Semitism, meaning the inferiority complex becomes, over time, this doesn't happen right away in the late 1800s as they move in. But as the Jews move in and begin draining the swamps, setting up towns, farming, producing, developing, the country develops, the locals who were there for a long time and unable to do any of that, you suddenly have why and how is this happening that these newcomers are coming and able to do all of these things. Now, the Muslim did not love the Jew to begin with, but introduced into that, this Eastern European anti-Semitism, which is, as we know from the Dreyfus trial leading into the Holocaust, is spreading, that it's not just that the Jew is not a Muslim, it's that intrinsic to the Jew is the problem. You have a very negative mix in the land of Palestine as the Jew gets there. Now, I don't want to paint a picture that it was like amazing. The Jews showed up and they became wealthy. It was not that way. I do not want to paint that picture at all because it's not accurate. As we mentioned, many Jews didn't stay. It was hard. It was difficult. A lot left. But as the Jews settle, they begin to develop the country. And as they begin to develop the country, more Arabs come to work. More Arabs are lifted up through it, and more hatred is entered as that comes. I want to share with you a fascinating exchange that summarizes what's taking place. This is from 1899. So this is at the end of this first wave. There are now, again, some 25,000 additional Jews, and all of these things are beginning to take hold that we're describing. Yosef Al-Khalidi, who's the mayor of Yerushalayim over 15 years, in different periods of time, he had many different terms, apparently. He was a very prominent political leader. He wrote the first dictionary, the Arab-Kurdish dictionary. He was a highly educated, well-known political figure. Writes a letter in French to the Reb Tzadok Cohn, who was the chief rabbi of France at the time. Now, Rabbi Cohn was not a Zionist. His constituents in France were not Zionists. They were enlightened Jews who wanted to remain Frenchmen. So he wrote to him as a person who was not in favor of the Zionist movement, and he wrote to him as follows. Some of these are direct quotes, and then the rest is just basically the summary of what he wrote. He writes, "Who can deny the rights of the Jews to Palestine? My God," he says, "historically, it's your country. However," he said, "as much as I can acknowledge it's your country, but right now it's inhabited. We're here," he said. "And since we're here, you need to find another place for the implementation of your political goals. Because if you try coming here, you can only take it by force, with cannons and with battleships," he wrote, "and the Arabs will never let that happen. Good Lord," he wrote, there's a quote, "the world is vast enough. Go find another place. In the name of God, let Palestine be left alone." So he writes this letter, which in essence we can say is saying, theoretically speaking, it's yours. Practically speaking, it's ours right now, and you're going to have to come and take it from us. We're not going to sit by and let that happen. And if you're ready to fight, okay, I'm telling you, go somewhere else. You have dreams of a land of your own. Go find it. You'll find it, and you won't have problems. But if you try coming here, it's never going to happen. This expresses, which will never be admitted today by an Arab, that really it's ours. Today you would never find that. But practically, he said, "Are you going to kill us for it? Good luck. It's not going to happen. Go somewhere else." Rabbi Cohn shows this letter to Herzl. It's 1899. So Herzl's already had he's already had two full Zionist Congress movements, and he's on his way. Uganda, which is going to be our next class, is going to be 2 years from now. So he's not opposed to finding another piece of land, Herzl. Listen to his response that reflects how naive the understanding of what to do with the Arabs were. I should really read you the whole thing. I think I have it here in front of me. I only gave you part of this here. He wrote back. Herzl wrote back. In other words, Rabbi Cohn gives a letter to Herzl. Give me the sheet again. Herzl writes back in French. He says, "The Jews, I assure you, have no military pretensions of their own. We have no thoughts of removing the local population," he said. We're not trying to start a fight. And then he expresses, I only gave you the shortened version. I don't have the whole thing in front of me. He says, "Explain to the people," he writes to Yosef Al-Khalidi, "that they only stand to benefit from the Jewish immigration. Explain to them," he says, "that their house is going to triple, will be four times more valuable, tenfold, with the presence and introduction of the Jew into the land, that they will become rich, that their historic motherland will flourish. Explain to them how much better it's going to be for them as we come." And he concludes, And if the Zionists are not wanted, we will search, and believe me, we will then find elsewhere what it is that we need. This expresses, you know, is it true 100 years later, is it true that an Arab living in the West Bank has by far the best quality of life of all of his Arab neighbors? Yes. Is he happy? No, because the Jew is in his land. At the end of the day, telling him that your home property will double or triple doesn't erase the fact that I believe you're in my land. And if you're in my land, it doesn't help me that it's better. And so while I reap the benefits, I'm still going to try to get you out. And this response from Herzl, I think both aspects are fantastic. There is the letter of Al-Khalidi saying, well, obviously this is your homeland, but guess what? We're in it, so you can't have it, is true. And the response of Herzl saying, but it's going to be better for you, is true. And it doesn't solve the problem. The problem is one that doesn't have a solution. So the fact that the Jews at the time and then the Zionists chose to just ignore it is because what's your option? Your other option is what? Not to go? Not to enter the land? That wasn't that. The Chov of Eitz Zion were pushing it. The Zionists were pushing it. What do you do with the local population? I don't know. Well, it began to come to a head in this first Aliyah movement, and we're going to see as we move forward through the 1900s, all the way through, of course, the 1920s when the pogroms and the various problems all the way through was going to be one long, continuous problem. Let me almost conclude with one more quote from Benny Morris, who's an Israeli historian, who points out that the major cause of tension and violence throughout the period of 1882 to 1914, which is covering both waves of Aliyah, the first one, which ended in early 1900, and then the second one, all of the tension, all of the violence, it was not accidents. They were not misunderstandings of the attitudes and the behaviors, but they were objective historical conditions. The conditions were such that were going to cause tension because of conflicting interests and goals of two populations. It's the reality. The Arabs sought instinctively to retain the Arab and Muslim character of the region. They wanted to maintain it as an Arab land and to maintain their position as its rightful inhabitants. The Zionists sought radically to change the status quo, to buy as much land as possible, to settle it, and eventually turn an Arab-populated country into a Jewish homeland. Guilty as charged, the Jews who came wanted to be a Jewish homeland. The Arabs who were there wanted to be an Arab homeland. Problem. Now, that doesn't have a simple solution. I'm not claiming any solution. I'm just claiming it wasn't dealt with. And as it's not dealt with, it has continued to flare up. It's one of the many issues. I'll say two things. Rabbi Wein, when he describes this problem, he says, listen, I had a math teacher who said, when you're taking a math exam and you're stuck on a problem, go on to the next one. Why waste your whole time to take your test on a simple problem? You're not going to get it now. You're not going to get it in 10 minutes. Just go on to the next. This was a problem that if any Jew during that era stopped to think about it, would say, I don't know what I'm going to do about this. So let's go on to the next problem. Maybe we could solve the water crisis a little bit better. So, okay, so I can't solve the Arab problem. You know, punt it to the next generation. I got to solve the problem of whatever. And then every generation looked at it. I don't know what the solution to this is. So eventually, I'll quote another thing from Rabbi Wein is, you know, he says, what's the reason why Mashiach hasn't come yet? He says, I'll tell you why Mashiach hasn't come. Because every single time the Jews have a problem, we say, when Mashiach comes, he'll fix this. When Mashiach comes, he'll take care of that. If you had the amount of problems to fix as we've placed on Mashiach, would you want to show up? So this is one of the problems. So we put it, I don't know. It's the Ribbono Shel'Olam's problem. Hashem is going to have to solve this problem at some point. But there's no human solution to two populations. And over the last 100 years, the Arabs have even just dug in more. Again, at the time, there was a certain number of Arabs who lived there. Since the Jews came, the Arabs came even more. So many of the Arabs that are there now, a great percentage of them, they haven't been there for 600 years. They've been there for the last 50 to 100 years. But the narrative has only grown stronger and stronger that this is an Arab national homeland. The Jews believe it's our national homeland. What's the solution to that problem? So nobody has figured it out yet, but it started really coming to a head. Obviously, it was destined to come to an end with this first Aliyah. Let's just conclude with summarizing some of the things that we had from this? What's the legacy of this first Aliyah? Again, this made-up construct of the first Aliyah from 1880 to 1900. They very much succeeded in building a new community. It was known as the Moshav, Rishon LeZion, Petach Tikva, Rosh Pina, Zichron Yaakov, Nes Tziona, Gedera, Rehovot. There's a long list of Moshavim or Moshavot that began during this period, many of which continue to exist until today, and that was a result of this Aliyah, these groups of Jews that came. Now, the numbers that actually set up these were all very small settlements. They estimate 3,000 to 4,000 went to these different Moshavs. Most went to the big cities. They went to Yerushalayim, they went to Jaffa, they went to Hebron, and integrated into traditional life. So to say that the first Aliyah movement became all of the Moshavs, like 25,000 farmers arrived in the land of Israel, not quite accurate. They did set up these towns and settlements, but most actually went into the big cities and integrated into life. The reality, again, many did not make it. Many returned to country of origin or left. If you look at the Israeli government, they have a historical part of their Israeli government website. They will define the first Aliyah as the first nationalistically driven return. True that there were others who came back, but again, notice this way. In other words, all the Jews who came back in the 1800s were religiously driven. They were driven by hopes of Mashiach coming. The first Aliyah is the first nationalistically driven return, which is debatable because the Zionist movement doesn't even begin to 1897, and this Aliyah begins in 1800. But this is how the Israeli government quotes. There's like a quote from their website. They were responsible for the establishment of the foundation of the later pioneering agricultural settlements, as well as the resurrection of the Hebrew language under the leadership of Eliezer ben Yehuda, which is during this time period. That also is disputed exactly what that is, but we'll leave that aside for another time as well. And this is all again from the Israeli website, the revolutionary changes in education and culture, especially due to the establishment of the Hebrew language schools, all of which begin during this time period of the first Aliyah. The big issue, which I conclude with, is that the division between the Jews and the Arabs, which was never really dealt with, as well as within the Jewish world, the secular, the religious, the Hasidim, the Sfardim, the Ashkenaz, all come to a head, and we continue to deal with today how to form this country of Jews from so many different areas, with so many different backgrounds and so many different agendas. How do you meld that? And it's not just like melding any people, it's like melding Jews, who we know we're not so easy to mold and to meld into different things. How do we get them together into this one country? That which really begins in earnest during this time period has continued to manifest itself until this very day. And we'll continue, Eretz Hashem, next week with the Uganda proposal and continuing development of Palestine next week, Monday night. Look forward to seeing you there. I wish you all a wonderful evening.